Off the ball. Rugby.
When you come across a gem, you keep him. We talk about Brice Toulon. I don't look upon him as a player. It's very rare you could say in modern sport, really, that he's a good friend.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
To play for Arsenal and to play for Ireland, that was my dreams, and that's what I wanted to do. I felt I had the ability to do that. I felt like I didn't want football at that moment of time, and I actually stopped playing for a few months because of it. Too much anger, there was too much hurt. It's quite scary, not only for my mum. Got me back playing, maybe the whole picture would be different. I just wished I was at home. I just wanted to be home. I didn't want to be there. And I remember ringing Emma the day of the game and just crying. You have to have anger to start. You do feel sorry for yourself. You have all them emotions. But very quickly, you do have to say, right, let's face it head on. My mind was always going there. I wanted to be a young manager, a young coach. I wanted to help people. Sometimes hurt people, broken people are just a little bit misunderstood. I know that because I was one of them. I remember looking into the stand and seeing families there, grandfathers, grandmothers with their kids and the generations, and you seeing them share that moment and crying and being together, it really hit home what that meant. That was powerful.
Were you born to be a footballer?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was. It's all I had, to be honest. I've said many times that we hadn't got anything really grown up, but we felt like we had everything. That was all down to our mum, and so all we really had was football, and it was easy to play football. You didn't have to have money. All you needed was two jumpers for goalposts and a football, and that's what we had. And so from a very, very young age, all I did was football. All I knew was football.
Who did you want to be?
Who did I want to be when I was younger? It was a strange one. I loved Franco Baresi from AC Milan. He was a centre-back at the time. He wasn't big in stature or hadn't got amazing athletic ability, but was so clever in his head. Could see the game so clearly. Stepped into midfield when that was probably, not, I wouldn't say unheard of, because there has been centre-backs in the past, but he did it so often. I'm so good at it. And he was creating what we all now know as overloads back then, like, you know. And when I started playing, I was centre back because of him.
When you were starting playing, were you thinking, I want to be like him, I want to go and I want to be a professional footballer? And
I think when you're a young player like that, and you see it when you're coaching young players now, it's the purest form of football you get, because it's so innocent in every way. So when I was that age and playing, I looked up to him and wanted to be that, but I never crossed my mind that I wanted to be a professional footballer.
What is the situation at home?
Yeah, me dad had left the family home. It just happened on a weekend. I remember things being a little bit strange in the house. And then on Monday morning, waking up and he was gone from the house. And for any young boy, for that to happen to, it really knocks you, because that's who you look up to. That has a really big effect on a young 10-year-old kid in Jobstown. And he was a football manager and coach in the local teams. So he was a good football player himself. So there's a lot there that you look up to at that point in time. And for that to be gone overnight is quite scary. I actually stopped playing for a few months because of it. I was angry and I felt like I didn't want football at that moment of time. And again, only from my mum, got me back in and got me back playing. Maybe the whole picture would be different. When I look back now, I was actually really lucky, because it made my relationship and my brother's relationship with our mother incredibly strong, because she had to be both the father figure and obviously my mother. So, and well, I had to grow quickly in every sense of the way. Because of my family situation, and then there was teams taking me to England when I was 10 years of age on my own. But coming out to Heathrow, not knowing who I was meeting, at 10 years of age is can be quite daunting. So you've got to front it up at that point. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but when you look back, that's what I was doing. And then when you do that once or twice, confidence comes, I think, quite naturally that you're quite comfortable in most scenarios. And
your mom then putting you on a plane at 10 when she was with you, did you ever get to talk to her about what that experience was like?
Yeah. I always said to her, she mustn't have liked me that much, trying to get rid of me at that age. But I think it was, when you look back, I've got young Josh, who's 11, and I would never allow him to get on a plane to Heathrow on his own without meeting the person. It was a crazy experience. Chelsea came in, wanted to sign me, brought me over, and next thing you know, you're on a plane. And
are you fearful of what awaits when you get off the plane?
I think there's a bit of everything. You're excited. I was a Chelsea fan growing up. So you're excited, that bit excites you. You're obviously fearful because you're sitting on a plane at 10 years of age, not knowing anyone else on the plane, not knowing who you're going to meet.
Who was guiding you on the football side of it at that age?
No one really, other than my mum. When you look at it later on, when we were dealing with clubs in terms of contracts, she was incredible at how she dealt with managers that had been quite successful and would be the biggest names in football at that moment of time. She didn't care, you know. She dealt with them how she would deal with me or you.
Well, I know Liam Brady still remembers her as a brilliant woman, but a fearsome negotiator.
Yeah, she was. And her and Liam had a brilliant relationship. And probably because Liam is from Dublin, he understood Dublin Mammy and how protective they are of their son. I think early on she would have told Liam where to go once or twice, and I think Liam thought, right, this isn't a normal negotiation here, this isn't a normal situation. Then my nan as well, it was very powerful in what I did and very influential in what I did, and her and Liam got on incredibly well as well. So she was a big part of what we did, and I think her and my mum together were probably the best agents I ever could have had.
Fair to say you're probably the best 14, 15-year-old in Ireland at that stage?
Yeah, I think it's quite comfortably say that, and that's not being cocky or arrogant. That was the facts of it, the truth. And there was, when you know you have 15, 20 clubs who have offered you really big deals at that moment in time, you have big brands that are offering you a lot of money to wear their clothes and wear their boots. You have sports drinks that are willing to pay X amount for you to do commercials for them, and all of that was coming in from the age of maybe 12, 13, 14.
Are you thinking at that age I've made it?
I think you're still really, really hungry to be a footballer at that age. There's people come to your door, there's, like I said, there's phones ringing every couple of hours or someone else, another manager from England, another chairman, another CEO. We knew that the interest was there, but at the end of it all, you're 14 years of age, you're living at home with your mum, your two brothers in Jobstown. The thought process was just still play football, like for the love of football, enjoy it, want to be better. We were still playing five-a-sides against, say, my older brother's mates, who would have been given 3 or 4 years to me, and I always just wanted to prove I was the best, better than them. I remember playing in Anfield against Everton, scoring a hat-trick. The next day, I go to Everton for a week and then come home. And the Friday I fly home, my brother had a game of Astro on the Friday with his friends, and I wanted to play because I wanted to show them that I was better than them. And that was the little bit of hunger, the little bit of desire that I had then. When you look back, it's gold dust. When you look back, the moment you lose that, you're in trouble. And for them years, I definitely had to.
Did you lose that?
Yeah. Football becomes a job, which it should never become. And that love and that desire disappears. And then you get lost. And football eats you up very, very quickly. So I definitely think in around 17, I definitely had lost sight of what I was there to do.
It's interesting how some players manage to somehow retain that.
You can see that I was on holiday last year, and I'm lying on the beach, this guy walking up and down behind us with a ball, and we turn around, it's Phil Foden, and he's just banging the ball off the wall. But the beauty of the whole thing was he just won Player of the Year in England, one of the best players in world football, and he's walking up and down the beach with a football. Everywhere he went, everywhere you seen him, he had a football. I think that gives you a little glimpse into why the best are the best. I was going there to play for Arsenal and to play for Ireland. That was my dreams, and that's what I wanted to do. I felt I had the ability to do that. That was definitely my mentality. And then at 17, like I said, once you lose that little bit of you, that little sharpness, that little hunger, desire, I think you take your eyes off the ball, you're done, you know.
What sparked that?
I turned professional at 17, and all of them offers that I was saying earlier to you, then you start seeing the financial gains from them. And overnight, you're worth a lot of money, and for a young kid from Jobstown who's never had anything, who's always had to fight for everything, to then wake up overnight and you can have basically everything or anything you want, that's quite scary. I just didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't understand it. And looking back now, I obviously wish that I knew what I know now. I remember going to check my bank account, and this is a genuine true story, and not understanding the money that was there, and having to ring my mum and say, there's X amount in my account. My mum would have never seen money like that. I came across money like that, and everything, that hunger and desire you had to want to play and want it tomorrow. So you're working so hard, and then you start seeing it as a bit of a job, and you start to think, well, what am I doing after training? The money I was earning at that moment of time would have been like first-team money. You just completely take your eye off the ball, and in the football industry, you can't do that, and especially at a major club like Arsenal. Thankfully, with drink or gambling or drugs, that was never an issue for me. It was more just, like I said, within you lose that little spark. My mum knew very, very early and told me so. Well, you're 17, you're young. She's probably looking down at me now, laughing at me and saying, I told you so. But at that moment of time, you think you know best. And I obviously didn't.
You're now dealing with a lot of those incredibly talented young 16, 17-year-olds, a lot of whom probably think they know best. Is it always on the kid, or could the club have been more protective of you?
It'd be very easy for me to turn around and say it was all Arsenal's fault, it was all the club's fault. But I think that's shying away from the fact that at the end of the day, it was me. There was a amount of times Liam called me into his office, Pat Rice called me in, Arsene Wenger called me in and had chats. The manager's telling you, he wants you to be the Pablo Aymar for Arsenal, and who at that moment of time was playing for Valencia and was a special player. And then as the conversations go on, they're starting to slightly change in terms of you can feel the temperature change in the room, and in terms of you've taken your eye off the ball, you need to go back working. So the warning signs were there from the club and from people within the club. The club did try and help. There's no doubt about that. But at the end of the day, I've got to own that, and I've got to take ownership of my decisions, and that's what it comes down to.
And whatever chance there might have been of regaining that spark and that deep love of football ends on a fairly dark incident where you end up getting attacked in London.
Yeah, I felt the door getting kicked in and balaclavas on, and my front door had four panels on the door, and they kicked through the bottom left panel of the door. You're trying to fight for your life, you're trying to fight because you know that these people aren't here to have a cup of tea, they're here to hurt you. And one of them was getting in through the door, and I swung and hit him, and he jumped back out, and then next of all, a gun came up through the door, and I was getting in through the door holding the gun, and then put it to my head, stood up and put it to my head, and was walking me backwards into the room, I remember one of them saying, shoot him. The tour guy came from behind and tried to stab me then, and he jumped over his friend's shoulder and tried to stab me in the head. And only for anybody's sort of natural reaction would be to try and defend themselves and push that away. So the knife went around, it went down, but it went around the front here and there. But only for it went around, and I tried to defend myself. The doctor said you were dead. He said it was literally, you're talking millimeters here from piercing your brain. And one of them jumping on me, standing on me, broke a few ribs, two ribs on each side. And I had a few watches at the time that were worth quite some money, and and they obviously, that's what they were after, and they took them, and I woke up in the hospital then. No one deserves to get stabbed, no one deserves to have their house broken into, of course, but I think the choices I made and the decisions I made back then led to that situation happening.
And sounds almost as though you still blame yourself for that happening.
I think I've had to do a lot of work throughout the years, from my playing days to deal with a lot of stuff that had happened. I think it is important that I did take ownership of that and understand it. And the really important bit is that it makes you better all round, and it makes you a better person. In a strange way, it's been a positive for me, because I know one thing for sure, that will never ever happen again.
You speak about it now in such a mature way. If we'd sat 20 years ago, would you have spoken about it like this?
Yeah, I wouldn't have spoken about it, Nathan, to be honest. I wouldn't have been ready. I was angry at the world. I was angry at everything, life, football. Back then, I felt that taking away my dreams of playing for Arsenal and Ireland, and I couldn't play contact sport for 12 months. So back then, I was so angry because I was looking for something to blame. I didn't know at the time, but I was looking for a reason why I didn't fulfil that potential as a football player. I didn't want anything to do with the game or people involved in it.
Did you think about quitting football at any stage?
Yeah, there's two times in my life. One was when my dad left the home that I was thinking of quitting. And then when that happened, because sometimes when you're a sports person or you're a footballer and things don't go quite as you would dreamed of them or wanted them to go, sometimes you look for an excuse, you look for a way out, you look for someone to blame. This is a situation that has happened that I could blame for me not going and playing at Arsenal, because your ego's hurt. You're coming home, you still see it to this day, young players coming home and hating the game and hating football and I was that person at that moment in time, but I had an excuse, I had a reason, and that was I was latching onto that. Look, I'd been stabbed and nearly died, and that was my reason for not fulfilling my potential. In truth, that wasn't the reason.
How did you find that bit of coming back to the league and football people wondering, well, what the hell has happened?
It's really difficult when you're coming home. Your ego's really hurt and you feel like you've let people down. As you get older, you understand you've let no one down, but at that moment in time, you feel like you've let people down. We have a big problem with that in this country. Young players coming home. I've been lucky since that time to have people that I can speak to around me, and can process it. But a lot of young men don't do that and can't do that. I haven't got the means to do that. And as a result, it eats them up for a long, long time.
So do you ever get back to enjoying football?
I did okay in a couple of leagues and a couple of cups. But from the age of 21 or 20 years of age, I wanted to be a manager and a coach. I'd start taking notes at that point. I'd start to really analyse teams from that point on. I felt I'd missed the chance to ever fulfil my potential. I felt that I could help people that were similar to myself. Sometimes hurt people, broken people are just a little bit misunderstood, and I know that because I was one of them. I played on until 27, I think, and then I remember myself and Graham having something to eat and him telling me that I needed to stop playing if I wanted to do what I wanted to do and be a young manager and coach. And that was something I didn't take well at all, and we had a big argument and we left the table, and then we met up a few days later and he was right, and that was the decision that was made.
Is there a backup? Is there a plan B if it doesn't work out?
No, I don't think you can go into it like that. Well, I certainly didn't. I think you've got to be all in when you decide to do something like that. When I explained it to my wife, she supported me. She believed in me, and I think she could see that I had that hunger. And we just had two young kids. 12 months apart, and it was a stressful time.
Initially, I thought it was scary because football, that's all he's ever done, but he always talked about being a coach, always. So I was just like, yeah, go for it, be the youngest coach that's out there, do it.
I had three jobs at that moment of time to allow me to coach, and I did an academy job at this club. I was run a lot of the young teams, and I was doing that for, you're talking £5,000 a year, which is, you try to tell your wife that that's your job when you have two young kids at home and bills to pay and kids to raise. And that's not an easy conversation to have, you know. And then you end up, I was currying in a van as well for a large part of the day as well. So it was, it wasn't easy. If people look at me now, and I always see young coaches now, and they think they just should walk into a job on X amount of money a year, full time, and that's not the real world, you know. I think you
are in at the deep end quite quickly. So you're working with Pat Fenlon, the manager of Tranmere Rovers. He leaves, you go in as caretaker manager, then you're appointed as permanent manager. What age are you when you?
31. Yeah. So it's I was in the academy coaching. I knew it's what I wanted. But you got to be very careful what you wish for as well at this club, especially because this isn't a club where you're going to play in front of 200 people every week. And even though when I came in, the team was fifth, and we had big teams ahead of us spending lots of money, these fans and this club still expect you to win.
Pressure. We could all feel the pressure, but he grew into the role so well. Yeah, I think it's. I think he's brilliant at it.
I always felt I could get them back there, but I needed the right people around me. I went to Met Glenn.
He came to my house and asked me to take the job. It was just that we spoke about doing things differently, and you know, we knew the club had to go in a different direction. Obviously, played against him as a player in the league. Wouldn't have known him very well. I sold my story to him. He sold his to me, and just hit it off. Just got on really well with him. I thought he was a top fella. We enjoy being here. We love being around the players. The office, we have great banter in the office. When it's time to work, we work like so.
Watching games, analysing players, it's all done together in this room.
It's an enjoyable place to come to work, so we're very lucky.
There was 18 or 20 players that were out of contract. I knew I had a lot of change coming.
It wasn't even, we needed, at the time, better players. We just needed different players.
I think if you look back at some of the names or the players we had at that time, there was a lot of, a lot of chaos within that group. And I think weeding out some of those personalities to get a stronger core group to what you see today. Remembering back to who I would have had around me that I would have looked up to in that change room. You know, Ronan Finn, Luke Byrne, Pico Lopez, Lee Grace, Alan Manus, all of those people who were brought in really brought a real structure and real core leadership group that has, you know, been a key part to why they've been able to go on and be so successful.
We wanted to start again, we wanted to go young, we wanted to refresh everything we were doing.
In those first couple of years when, you know, it's taken a little bit of time to fully get up and running, how do you deal with that?
Back then, it was extremely difficult. There's no getting away from that.
Were you doubting yourself?
Yeah, I think you have major doubts. I think anyone who says in this position that they don't doubt themselves is lying. I would doubt myself to this day. And at that time, I think it was Cork and Dundalk are really dominant, and that was a frustrating time for our fans. I can understand why there was pressure, why the fans were not happy at that moment in time.
Yeah, it was obviously tough. I think I remember him standing on the touchline on his own, and the banner came up, and I went to get up, and the fort officials don't let you move, obviously. So I remember saying to him, I'm going out to him, so if you need to send me off, send me off. So I remember going and standing with him and seeing, I remember just thinking, we weren't too bad in the game, actually. I don't think it was interesting at them times because we could see ourselves improving. But results weren't going our way, so.
For us, it was clear that we were going in the right direction. It was just going to take a bit of time. And
what we were doing was actually working. It's just going to take a little bit longer than what people thought, like, you know. And we spoke to a lot of them lads with the banner now, the great fellas. They just, that's what they felt at the time.
The not nice part, though, was obviously if my kids were young and they were at the game and they're seeing that and hearing that, and that's never nice.
And I remember one of the mammies calling me. I wasn't at the match that night, and one of the mammies calling me saying, oh, Jaden's really upset here. They're all shouting, get Stephen out, get Stephen out.
That, when that happened to Jaden, I remember that quite clearly. It was very good to have that conversation. I'm so young to say, it doesn't mean them people don't like Daddy. It means they don't like the job he's doing. There's a big difference there, you know, there's a big difference. So
you have to understand they're fans and they're passionate, but it's not nice to hear, of course. When they're personal about stuff, it's not nice, but it is what it is.
People are allowed to have an opinion on your job. 99% of them are wrong, but they're allowed to have an opinion. That's part of the job. And you have to accept that. When it's personal, I think that's when it becomes different. And I think that's when we've got to remember that there's a human side to this, like, you know. The 10,000 people that show up out here to watch games, I don't care if you've helped someone off the pitch during the week, but he doesn't score on a Friday and you don't win the game. But you have to obviously be very, very conscious that you're here to win football matches. We've created a winning culture that was missing for quite some time. You get expectations, obviously, you get demands, you get younger fans that all they know is success. So when they don't see it or they see it getting beat, it's a bit of a shock.
The 2019 FAI Cup final, how important is that day?
We knew we were building, we knew we were there. You could feel the team was there, you could feel it. Sometimes you know when you play against different teams and clubs, and Dundalk and Cork were the teams at that point in time. But you knew we'd caught them and you knew we were going ahead of them. But it's okay feeling that. You have to actually earn that on the pitch and you have to show that. So winning that game was definitely the turning point. It's probably one of my favourite memories in football.
Winning the cup was a special, special day, like, you know. We spoke about before, if we win it, we'll go back out onto the pitch. So we went back out and brought the cup out with the players and all the staff. And we sat in the centre circle for probably a good of an hour, and had a few beers and a sing-song, and really took in the moment, because it had taken the club so long to get to win this trophy back, and we wanted to really enjoy it.
I remember looking into the stand and seeing families there, grandfathers, grandmothers with their kids and the generations, and you're seeing them share that moment and crying and being together, and that was powerful. Like, you know, I remember looking at that and I really, really got a sense of what it meant to people. And it was a special moment, something that I'll never forget.
Everything's going swimmingly, and then life comes to a shuddering halt.
I don't think we'll ever forget that moment in the hospital when the nurse sat us down, the doctor, sorry, sat us down and told us that that Josh had cancer, and I think it was, just your world just changes at that moment, everything stops. And
anybody's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yeah, it just changed everything in that moment, it just changed everything.
Well, you're just trying to deal with it in your own head, so yeah, it's scary, so scary.
Josh was 8.
Yeah.
At that stage. When did you first start to notice that he wasn't himself?
So it was about 3 weeks before he came back from a football game, and he got into the car and he's like, man, my leg's sore. And I thought it just happened at the game, and then, so thought he just hoarded at football, and then just keeping an eye on it, and then the next day he started getting a limp, so it was going into his back then. So Stephen got him into one of the doctors and they arranged straight away for bloods to be done in Tallaght. The next day, yeah, they gave us the news that he had leukemia, which was horrible. I had went home and Stephen was there, and the doctor came in to give the news, and it just didn't sink in for like weeks, even though he was running. He went into really aggressive treatment at the start, so it was horrible, yeah. You just didn't have time to think, and then after a few weeks, you're like, whoa, what just happened there? Stephen stayed with him, so I went home to tell Jaden and Ella. No, that was just horrible, yeah.
How was Josh?
I remember when it happened, Stephen saying, this has happened, we have to deal with it. we just day by day. And that's the way we try to live a normal life for everybody, for ourselves, have time for each other, have time for the other kids, still try and go on holidays, try and keep everything as normal as we can, just so it makes things easier for Josh and us. But of course it's difficult, but we're in it. We have to, we can't run away from it. We just have to keep going. It's on your mind all the time. It's something that's there 24/7. It's a worry.
At the start, it's really hard to accept because your job as a parent is to protect your kids at all costs. And at that moment, you feel like you can't do that. You feel like...
You're angry.
Yeah, you feel like you've let them down. You feel like the one thing you're supposed to do when you have kids is try and protect them as much. And any parent would tell you that. So that bit is really, really difficult. Josh's first few months of chemo, when he was in heavy, heavy treatment and his immune system was on the floor, we went to London and had him on tubes and took him to... Now, looking back, we do laugh at times and think...
We done that. We shouldn't have done that.
We shouldn't have done that, but we were trying to keep it as normal as possible for Josh and our other two kids, more importantly, that they still had a normal life. I remember going to Bulgaria to play Ludo Gretz in Europe, and it was literally a short time after Josh had got diagnosed. And I remember ringing Emma the day of the game and just crying. And I just wished I was at home. I just wanted to be home. I didn't want to be there. I just felt like... Sometimes you just feel like you're in the wrong place. I don't know if that makes sense. You just feel that emotionally, everything, you're just not there. And I just spent, I don't know how long on the phone to Emma crying about, should I be at home, And that was hard. This is the hand we've been dealt with.
Yeah, and we have to just roll with it.
We have to try and play it as best we can.
You can be well one day, you can be sick the next. It's just, so you just have to go with it.
How do we get through this as a family? How do we get through this for Josh and Jaden and Ella? And the way to do it is just face it head on. And you have to have anger to start. You do feel sorry for yourself. You have all them emotions. But very quickly, and you do have to say, right, let's face it head on.
So it was 3.5 years. So it was, you just have to, you couldn't live angry every day. But he's became a pro at it. He's doing it now, 3 years now. But he really does take it in a stride.
He's been incredible. Them moments that you talk about, the day he lifted the trophy, he was just out of hospital. And he was so sick at that time, But all he was talking about was the game on the Friday night and being there. I remember bringing him down to theatre that week, and before he gets knocked out to go into theatre, all he was talking about, am I going to the game on Friday? So it definitely gives you that drive and hunger to be better. When Josh got sick, I asked the players to give us that night for him, to give him that distraction, and they were incredible. They stepped up and gone win a league and give Josh that moment that we will never forget,
First of all, I couldn't believe it. I was thinking, what's the chances on the two of us working together and both their kids ending up with cancer? So what he's done, him and his wife Emma and his other kids, is incredible. And their extended family, how they've handled it has been incredible. It does connect you. You do feel tighter because of it. And it makes you realise we're so lucky to have what we have every day.
He's been at awards deals and people see him on the stage, and at that point he obviously had no hair and looked really sick. So he was so conscious of not having any hair and people seeing that in public.
He had this fancy suit on him going to one of the awards, and because he wore his cap all the time because he was conscious of having the bald head. And we were like, no, you look smashing, take the cap off. But it took a while, didn't it, that persuading, but he did.
As much as we've guided him and helped him,
He's helped us.
He's helped us so much. It's made him sort of wise beyond his years. He's so clever and he's emotionally so aware of himself and everything else. He's had real hurt. We're obviously getting sick, but he's lost one of his really good friends to a similar illness.
In May last year, yeah.
And that must be tough.
That was hard.
Yeah. How he's dealt with that has been, all of that has been incredible, you know, and it's definitely helped me become a better manager.
Incredible, like, you know, throughout the years he's been fantastic, and he's led us, still being able to lead a dressing room and staff is credit to him, like, you know.
The toughest night, I think, maybe was the night down in Cork with the supporters. What are your memories of what was said that night and what happened afterwards?
Yeah, well, I remember going over to the, I called their assistant manager, I think it was at the time, I can't remember, because I was standing with him and I heard him and I seen him getting a bit upset. I wasn't sure if I heard it first, actually. I'm thinking, am I hearing that right? Like, so it was awful. I can't remember the words, to be honest, but it was actually shocking. So I called the one of the coaches over and I said, are you listening to this? Am I hearing this right? Like, you know, so he said, I didn't hear that. And so I went to the security. I said to the security guy, can you go in and stop this? Like, you know, I said, his son's really sick. I said, he's struggling here and we're allowing this to happen at a football game. It should be nowhere. Like, you know, I said, it's awful.
And they start shouting really, really nasty stuff regarding Josh's treatment and hoping that the treatment didn't go well and hoping he didn't recover. And that was extremely difficult to hear.
I think one of the lady stewards went in and pulled the lads out of the pub.
I always feel there's not much in a stadium or in football that can really hurt me or really affect me, because football's football, you get a bit of stick. But when it goes to talking about a 9 or 10-year-old kid that was fighting leukemia, I found really, really disturbing and it really affected me. The bus journey home from Cork was obviously a really difficult one, and I had 3 or 4 conversations with my wife on the phone on the way home, and it was one of the most difficult moments in my life, for sure.
Probably one of your lowest points ever in your career, to sit on that bus, get on that bus on the way back and know what he's going through. And obviously it affects us all. We all love Josh, but his father is sitting there listening to this. It's just, there's no place for it. Like,
it was really shocking. It really took me back. And the first thing I thought about was obviously Josh and my family and how I could protect them from hearing about it. I couldn't. Social media obviously was so strong. And my son heard about it from his friends, and so it was extreme. It was probably the only point in time that I really, really questioned about whether this was something that I should continue, because I don't think anybody should hear anything like that in any walk of life.
Credit to him, steps up and just rolls with the punches and moves on to the next one.
And from there, it just skyrockets. 4 league titles in a row, all very straightforward, I'm sure. Not much going on in the background. You were the best team, you just kept rolling over season on season.
Yeah, I think that's what people think. Yeah, it just happens. Shamrock Rovers, it just happens. Sometimes people forget the journey. A lot of people will talk about us and talk about budgets and talk about and forget that we've had to earn this. We've had to build it, we've had to sell the most players that any club has ever sold. And at the time when it really hurt us, because we were trying to build a team, but understanding we have to sell a player to improve us. Being successful twice is rare, but doing it 3 or 4 times is special, because it's about showing up every day. For you put that cup, then 4 league wins, and I think we were 5 minutes away from winning the 5th one, and then you throw 2 group stages in between that. The players deserve incredible credit for showing up. These players could have been forgiven for thinking, where else do we go from here after winning 3 leagues or 2 leagues and a group phase and a cup? But that was, never got a sense of that. It was all about wanting to be better.
How do you deal players who maybe lose that spark?
Or sometimes you try and rack your brain and think, how did I not connect with him? Or how did that break down, that relationship? How could I not get inside his head? How could I not help him fulfill his potential, or get him back to what he was? And that can be hard to accept at times. Once you see that little attention to detail or that little edge leaving people, once you see that slipping, it's time to shake hands and move on, because success has no loyalty.
Pure sporting achievement is the 4 in a row, the one that means the most?
Yeah, it is. The COVID one annoys me a bit because I think that team would have broke all records. I think that team was special. But definitely the under four. Everyone talks about the Shamrock Rovers team that did the four. I'm lucky enough to be in touch with a lot of them to this day and speak to a lot of them, the Liam O'Briens, Pat Bourne, Mick Bourne, John Cole. So yeah. Once we did one and then you do the second one, my aim was always I want to be there. I want to be sit at that top table with them. And that was the aim and ambition. Coaching and managing are very, very different. But I'd always wanted to be that coach or manager that, like I said, could help people and the ones that are broken are a little bit hurt, and then the ones that are coming up from young and are naive and fresh, you know the pitfalls that are in front of them, so you can try and guide them.
For me, everything was always calm and measured because I think, you know, that's the way I work as an individual. I'm quite calm and quite measured, and I think we'd be the same in that way. All information was given in, you know, a very trusting and calm manner, and it was just a real sense of trust. Probably a year, 18 months before I even played for Shamrock Rovers first team, where I was struggling to get minutes for the under-17s. And Stephen even stepped in at that moment to make sure I was getting the minutes I needed. I was under him for, you know, a pretty short amount of time. It just meant that our connection was able to grow and grow as I left the club. And it's been like he's been a manager to me, but a personal manager to me ever since I've left, which is a great relationship to be able to have. Every step of the way, every decision that was made, there would have been, you know, contact there for advice, and anytime I was coming home, I was at games, I was going out for dinner, whatever it was, and making sure that, you know, I was pushing in the right direction. 2 weeks post-surgery now, and then from 6 weeks I have a review with the surgeon. We sit down and chat about not just football but just life in general. It's crazy the amount of managers you still work with in this day and age where, you know, they see players as robots or as assets and not as people. And there's only a few managers I've worked with in my time that do see players as people. And Stephen's definitely one of them. And those are the managers who can get the most out of people and the most out of players. And they're the ones who can control the changing room the best, because there's that empathetic side, there's that emotional intelligence piece that a lot of managers just overlook. You don't stay at a club like this for this long and win as much as you do without having that ability to be able to connect with people on a personal level.
What about your own personal ambitions then?
I've made no secret of the fact that I want to manage at the highest level. I want to manage at the highest level possible, and that's my ambition, that's my hunger, that's my desire. Has there been opportunities in the last few years? Yeah, there's been opportunities, but the personal circumstances don't allow for that. Please God, in the future we get good news and the whole picture becomes clearer. In the last 2.5 years, there's no job in the world that would have taken me away from my family situation. So it's irrelevant. Would I like to manage the senior national team of this country? Of course I would.
What happened around the Ireland job? Did you feel you had a chance? Were you approached at any stage?
Yeah, I was approached. I was approached through back channels at the start, asking, is it something that I would be interested in and having that conversation? Obviously, the answer was yes. A meeting was set up between myself and Mark Hannam and Jonathan Hill. And unfortunately, both of Mark and Jonathan were late for the meeting, 15 minutes late, so I left.
Well, when he spoke to me about it, initially he said, you're going to kill me, like, you know. And I said, what? He said, I came off the call. And I said, right, why? He said, they left me waiting whatever amount of time was. And I thought, good. That's how I felt, really. I thought, and it's not an arrogance, it's respect, like, you know. I think they wouldn't leave Jose Mourinho waiting 10 minutes. Either you're there on merit and they respect you the same as everyone else, or they don't.
That probably summed up how serious the interest was for me to have the job, which I found disrespectful and not good enough, to be honest with you. If I was someone that they were really serious about having that job, they would not have been late for that meeting.
So he's no less valued than anyone else, so I think it was the right thing to do.
It's fair to say, Stephen, that the League of Ireland has changed quite dramatically since you took over, in terms of the amount of people that are coming here to Tala every Friday night that are interested in the games. Every match now is live on TV. All your press conferences are covered by media. Everything you say now is back page. Sometimes it's front page. How have you dealt with that part of it, with becoming a household name, a very recognisable figure everywhere you go?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. It doesn't bother me either way. Like, you know, I think, again, as you're in the job, you understand that part of your job, and I've always found strange that when I came into the job that managers and the media didn't get on and didn't speak, and there was a real hostility there as if they were trying to trip them up. And I actually think quite the opposite. I think the media have such a big role to play in growing the league and helping it grow. And so I've always been the opposite and being quite open and honest with the media. There's times you can't be for certain reasons. But I think the media have a big role to play in that. Sometimes they annoy you with the questions and when form isn't good or you're not doing well. But again, you've got to accept that and take that. So when I came in here, there was average of 1,200 fans at these games. Now we're averaging 7,000. The league is definitely going in the right way. And we all have a part to play in that. If that means that I've got to sit in front of the cameras and do media during the week after games, I have no problem with that, I think.
And Shamrock Rovers has run maybe different to any other club with the member model, the private investment. That's obviously been front and centre in recent weeks. How have you managed to navigate that, and how much of a stress and a strain has that been on your time in recent years?
It's been times when it's been extremely difficult. There's been directors that have worked against me and tried to get me to leave the job. And when you combine that with obviously doing the job, with the personal situation at home, it can become quite tiresome at times.
People find that hard to believe, but that the manager who's been the most successful in modern times, that somehow that's not enough?
The members are incredible. The support they've given me, not just on the pitch, but my personal life, is incredible. And I can't thank them enough for that. But there's no getting away from, like I said, things that have happened in the past. And sometimes it's not about success, sometimes it's about control. And when that becomes the driver, it's very, very dangerous. Some people don't want to hear that. I don't want to accept that that was the case. But that's the truth.
Did you ever get to a stage where you thought it's not worth the hassle?
Of course you do, yeah. Of course, there's definitely times that happens. You know, you think to yourself, is it worth it, like, you know, because you're giving up so much to yourself, and the only reason you're doing it is to try and be successful and bring success to the club. And in the meantime, there's people in the background working to try and remove you from your job and making it difficult at every turn. That's the reason you do it. You stay in the job is to, for the team, obviously, because the players are incredible and have helped me, but for the fans who show up every week and back us through thick and thin, and travel around Europe, travel up and down the country. And at the end of it, the good days definitely await the bad days. That's what gets you through.
How big a driver is it to knock shells off their perch?
I don't think they're on any perch, to be honest with you, Nathan. We're the ones that have set the standards here for 10 years. We're the ones that have won 4 in a row. Have two group stages. We were very, very average domestically last year, and we're 5 minutes away from winning the fifth title. So I don't think anyone's on any perch.
I think we saw Friday your passion for it's still there anyways.
Well, I think if you lose that, you're done, you're dead. Like I said to you at the start of the conversation, I lost that as a footballer 17, and I was done. I promise myself, my team, my family, this club, that the day that goes, it's time to stop.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.